Right off the top of my head, I can think of at least one song and one movie named Starting Over, and there are probably many more with similar themes. It's an appealing thing, stepping out of a place of turmoil in life and finding new work, new friends, new lovers. It's a bit less appealing late in life. Who'd want to start from scratch at age 60, for example? Meredith Marin did not volunteer for such a mission, but she got one, and she tells the story in her book, The New Old Me, subtitled My Late Life Reinvention. Meredith writes up a storm for a living. In addition to the dozen books she's written and published, she's a book critic and essayist for the likes of the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and Salon.com. And she's in Ashland for a speaking appearance tonight at 7 at Bloomsbury Books. So good to have you in the studio.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Well, you picked a great story to start with, getting your wedding ring cut off.
Oh, yeah.
What happened?
Well, I was experimenting with my wedding ring, which had outlived its usage, unfortunately. I had been married happily for 16 years to the person I planned to be married to for the rest of my life, and the marriage dissolved, and I also lost all my life savings thanks to a Madoff-type scheme, and my best friend and my dad got diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So the money problem being the most pressing, as mortgage payments tend to be, I got a job offer in Los Angeles and pretty much overnight packed my car and went. So I found myself there with an obsolete wedding ring, and I was having a little trouble, as people do, letting go of the marriage. So the form that took was I was taking the ring off and putting the ring back on, putting it around my neck, putting it here, putting it there, and I finally put it on the right hand just transition. And I cut myself really badly, and I went to the ER, and of course they wanted to cut the ring off. The finger that got cut, oddly enough, was the finger with the wedding ring.
The way you phrase it in the book was really interesting. The doctor says, you know, I'm going to have to cut this off. And I thought he meant the finger when he first
Well, later he did mean the finger, and he gave me a choice between the two. Either the ring goes or the finger goes. So that made the choice a little easier.
Wow. So you gave us a pretty good rundown of all the things that had happened. I mean, so you were in a blissful marriage, or what seemed blissful, for a long time.
Right.
Until what? What do you think made the change there?
I would say that undiagnosed problems, unspoken problems, and that combined with, you know, it's a great idea to be a lesbian late in life. You'd save a lot on not only tampons, but Viagra. And I thought I had it nailed. I thought, what a great idea to be gay now. And but that also means two women with sets of hormones. And menopause was not helpful in this situation. But really, the answer to the question is I don't know. And there are certain stories I could tell or factors I could name. But I think what I've learned the hard way in the last 5 years especially is that when something big and bad happens, there's always a lot of stories and very rarely any real answers.
As you'd mentioned, I mean, this seems like it's a trio starting off. Your career had collapsed. You'd lost your life savings. Your marriage had collapsed. But you just mentioned some other things. You mentioned your best friend briefly. Let's expand that a bit. Who was Patricia?
Patricia was an amazing scholar and intellectual, but also the biggest heart on earth. And she happened to have a black standard poodle. And if this were TV instead of radio, you'd see why she called him my son. People would often stop us on the trail and say that we looked alike. We had a hiking date 2 or 3 times a week, every week. And when my marriage started disintegrating, Patricia played the role of rematchmaker. She was very much, she identified with my now ex-wife, and she would, you know, I would walk and walk and cry and tell her all the things that were going wrong, and she would tell me the explanation as to why my wife was acting that way, because she understood her in a way that I didn't. And we always used to joke that if Patricia ever stopped walking with me, that the marriage would end in a day. And in fact, Patricia had a diagnosis of cancer many years before. She was already outliving her expectancy. And one day after we went for an hour and a half very vigorous hike, she went into the hospital and only came home to die. So it was actually quite unexpected. But she was really holding my world together, I think, as friends can do. So her loss was huge.
Was there any part of you that as you loaded your clothes in the car that day thought, this is going to be a good thing?
Oh, hell no. The word good had long ago evaporated from my lexicon. No, there was no good feeling whatsoever. The only thing that helped was massive doses of denial. The job, when I first got it, was supposed to be for 3 months. And so my wife and I said, well, 3 months apart will do us some good, and you'll get some money and you'll come back.
You had had a couple of child separations even before that, hadn't you?
Yes, it had been 3 years of hell, basically.
Okay.
Anyone who's been in a long marriage that they had nothing but hope for and then nothing but despair about probably can relate to the idea that the line between being masochistic and in denial versus doing everything you can to save a marriage is very thin sometimes.
So you drove to L.A. to take a job. Now, beyond the job, what else had you planned in terms of, like, where you were going to live and where you meet people, anything like that?
None of the above. The whole thing happened almost overnight. And when I arrived, I was lucky enough to have a friend. Actually, I'll give her some credit, the writer Susan Orlean. We had become friends on Twitter. We'd spent one day together in our lives, and she and her husband offered me their house for a couple of months when they were going out of town. And all I had to do was not kill the cats. And I so I had no idea of the geography of L.A. and no idea about anything about L.A. I just arrived at their house and opened my suitcase on the floor and stayed there for 2 months. And it went on like that for the next 3 or 4 months until I had accumulated enough money to pay first and last month's rent.
All right, so we have a P.S. to the subtitle of the book. You can call it P.S. The Cats Did Live.
The Cats Lived.
Okay. The book is called The New Old Me, My Late Life Reinvention. Meredith Marin is the author of the book and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's quite an accomplished writer as well, and it definitely shows as you go through the book as she tells what is often a heartbreaking story, but somehow manages to get us to laugh out loud at times as well. She'll be in Ashland tonight at 7 at Bloomsbury Books. You can join the conversation here on the Exchange now by phone or by email, but when we come back from a break in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Meredith Marin, an accomplished writer with a dozen books already written and published. She's a book critic and essayist for the New York Times, the Boston Globe, Salon.com, and others. Made a career for a very long time as a freelance writer. And then what happened to a lot of writers is that there just wasn't much of a market for writing. So she lost her income, lost her life savings in what she describes as a Bernie Madoff-style scheme, and lost the love of her life and her marriage, and left the Bay Area, moved to L.A., and tells the story in The New Old Me, My Late Life Reinvention. Who'd want to change at 60? She didn't, but it happened. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the discussion or have some comparisons with your own life to share with us. Or you can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. There's something really poignant in the first part of the book, though, about not just like loading the stuff in the car and leave. I mean, you've been sleeping in the guest room in the place
right.
in Oakland for weeks, I guess, by that time. Throw your stuff in the car, the clothes from the attic, the car is filled, you drive off. Down I-5, which you describe as a desolate moonscape. It's pretty at times, you have to admit.
Well, but the cow factory farm is always a good inhale.
The one you can smell from 2 miles off,
exactly.
Yes, absolutely. But you get to L.A., you're staying with other people, and at first, the way you describe it, you're staying in a house with the husband of a friend.
Right.
Yeah, so but you didn't even have a place of your own to cry.
Right, exactly. That was the hardest thing. I never realized, as I say in the book, you know, what a luxury a door is. And when the friend invited me to crash at her place, she told me she'd be out of town for the summer, but she didn't tell me I'd be sleeping in the middle of the living room. And I was so grateful just to have a place to go. But the first night, things kind of came to a head rather quickly when she had left some wooden antique screens to surround this couch in the middle of the floor.
She does everything with style.
She does everything with style, exactly. Style over utility often. And these were very heavy antique screens. And apparently in the middle of the night, I moved enough to knock not one, but two of them over onto me. One broke over my knee and the other one broke the stair rail that was, you know, adjacent. And That was a great way to earn my welcome with a stranger. You know, the man came running up the stairs and took one look at his demolished living room and, you know, broken guest. Mm-hmm. And that was my first night in L.A.
Wow. So,
but something good happened that night, too, that I talk about in the book, which was totally unexpected. I got a visit from God, which was completely not what I was imagining happening. I had had a relationship with God when I was a small kid, grew up New York and anti-Semitic Jewish in New York.
Anti-Semitic Jewish.
Anti-Semitic Jewish, meaning my parents' idea of how to get ahead for themselves and for their kids was to pretend that we were not Jewish. And so I had grown up in a very Jewish neighborhood, and all the other kids were getting noisemakers and jelly apples and all kinds of fun things, getting dressed up and going off places. And I used to beg to go to synagogue, and my parents wouldn't let me because, you know, we weren't supposed to be Jewish. So I found God myself as a 5-year-old and prayed every night as a child. And then when I became a hippie, revolutionary, runaway renegade, God wasn't really on the agenda. So didn't have any conversation with God for about 50 years. And that night in LA, I found out why it is that desperate people, poor people, oppressed people are often the most God-loving people, because I became one of them that night.
And was that a continuous?
It continued. Yeah, God is still hanging around me, which is really a nice thing for me, and I hope it's good for him too.
You talked about your hippie years just now, so give us a sense of the depth and breadth of your activism. It sounds like it's been a very important part of your life.
Deep, wide. Yeah, I wasn't happy in my family, and when I went to high school, I met, and this was 1965. There was a crowd of kids standing on the corner, and the choice between standing on the corner and going into class was a no-brainer for me. I hated school, always did. And so I stayed on the corner with the kids out there, and they were doing things like publishing an underground newspaper in the school, which we mimeographed in someone's living room, and smoking banana peels to see if they really would get you high. Answer, they won't. Nobody try it. Do not try that at home. And also we were organizing big demonstrations, being part of some of the national demonstrations. And also I personally organized a pants strike at the school, which when I told my kids that, they were like,
a strike for
girls to be allowed to wear pants. And they were trying to, I told them this when they were in junior high, and they were like, I can't think of a time I've seen a girl not wearing pants to school. But it was verboten for, you know, until then. And so one day we got all the girls in the school to wear pants, and they suspended the entire female population of the high school for that day. So I just became an activist that way. It was where the fun was. It was where the cool kids were. It was where the pot, sex, drugs, and rock and roll were. And so we, in those days, it was really easy to combine all of the above. We had a lot of fun. I quickly ran away from home and lived in a commune and continued writing, but writing as an activist. You know, I wrote for newspapers and distributed flyers and things like that. And it was really, in a lot of ways, the most holistic time of my life, because the way I loved and the way I lived and the way I ate and the way I danced and the way I changed the world were all integrated. And it felt really great.
We're talking about later in Meredith Marin's life generally, though, because the title of her memoir is The New Old Me, My Late Life Reinvention, age 60 and had lost a job, lover, and money, and had to start all over. So by the time you took the job in L.A., how long had it been since you'd worked in an office?
25 years.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, the day I was going to work, leaving the place where I was crashing, and the stranger I was having breakfast with said, have a good day. And I thought, well, what are the odds of that? You know, he went to work last Friday. I went to work last 25 years ago. So I wasn't really looking forward to it.
Well, you describe yourself as almost unemployable most of your adult life. Why?
I continue to be pretty much unemployable. I don't think that, you know, coming of age at 15, I ran away from home at 16, living the way that I lived when I really was forming into the human that I still am, It didn't bode well for taking instructions. It didn't bode well for doing anything that didn't feel like it was perfectly aligned with my impeccable values and beliefs.
Oh, so the way you lived and danced and acted and
everything,
yeah, so
just not used
yeah.
to. Let's start with wearing a bra. Like, who does that, really? 5 days a week? I don't think so.
Not for you. So, but you ended up working for a fashion company.
I did.
Places,
I did. Yeah. Yes, yes. Because I wasn't challenged enough, we thought we would go get a job in Hollywood with some 20-year-old, 20-somethings, and all of them basically looked like models. Many of them had been models or were models. And what we got to do was try on clothes that this company was making in front of mirrors, standing next to each other, 25-year-old, size 0, 6 foot her, and not so much me.
No numbers given there, right?
No numbers.
Some of the things, though, that, like, did anyone tell you to wear your Lulus tomorrow? Did you understand any of that question
I had
when it was first asked?
You know, never have I felt so old as when I would try to decipher the things that were being said to me on a regular basis, the language, everything. So on my second day of work, my boss said, don't forget to wear your Lulus tomorrow, and left my office. I had no idea what she was talking about. I got my workout wear at Target, and it turned out that every Wednesday there was Workout Wednesday, and the company paid a personal trainer to come into the office. Everybody stopped work. Everybody wore their Lulus to work every Wednesday. And then we would work out really hard for an hour and on company time. And then we would all line up for the shower on company time, take our nice leisurely showers and change out of our skin tight Lycra that we were wearing to work.
So what kind of apprehension? Feel free to adjust that term about about the first company workout.
Oh, my God. I mean, just, you know, I could have been wearing burlap sacks and still felt very inadequate next to the people who I was working with. But coming to work in Lycra on my third day, that was a challenge. But, you know, in a way, it was a good challenge. It was very representative of all the challenges I was facing, because I did go to the city that reveres youth and beauty above all else. And it was so extreme that, you know, when I was feeling old, brokenhearted, rejected, you know, and not attractive, it was an amazing place to land, because there was no middle ground. I could not survive in Los Angeles if I were going to look at every other woman or, you know, look at the billboards and compare myself. That was absolutely not an option, and live.
Meredith Marin's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. At age 60, with her marriage, her job, and her savings collapsing, she had to move from the Bay Area to L.A. And she tells the story in her memoir, The New Old Me, My Late Life Reinvention. Meredith will be at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland tonight at 7. She's here now. Join the conversation. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You did get your work schedule arranged to leave some time for freelancing. And did you get any good gigs?
I did. Well, one freelance editing gig I got was with Kenny Loggins, and I write about this in the book. He, a mutual friend set us up. He wanted to write a book about, oddly enough, turning 60. And so we spent some time together talking about the possibility of his writing a book. And it turned out when we met the first time that he had recently lost the love of his life. And so we ended up sort of scrapping the day's work, went to the beach, went to lunch. I, in my case, drank quite a few margaritas. He was not drinking, as he said. He'd had his fun. And just talked about heartbreak all day. And we both cried. And it was like this incredibly emotional connection. And we're still friends now. Never did write the book. Turns out writing a book actually is a lot of work.
So obviously things were beginning to line up for you professionally. It seems like that happened, though, a few times in your early days in L.A., that people were able to see the sadness in you and say, how you doing?
You know, the myth about L.A., it's not a myth that there are an inordinate number of inordinately traditionally beautiful people there. Okay, that's true. The traffic thing, true. But the thing that isn't true is that it's this vast social wasteland, and that everyone there is just knocking people out of the way to get to the top of the entertainment business. That exists. But next to that exists this whole other world where people are looking for a way out of the wasteland, the social wasteland, the emotional wasteland, the freeway wasteland, and want to have a real life even within this semi-unreal place. And so what I found once I got really humble and aggressive about making friends, that once I was in with a certain group of people, as long as I was real with them, because that's the criteria, you know, if you're bonding with people to make a real life within an unreal environment, you got to stay real. Those people would take me in and make me part of their families. And I found an openness to real serious friendship in LA in a way I hadn't ever before. I'm sure part of it was my own state. You know, I was kind of broken open. There was not a lot of energy for artifice or, you know, putting on airs. I had no airs to put on.
Yeah, you were depressed enough to just be as real as you
could. Yeah.
I have to wonder about just the general feeling about L.A. I, as a native New Yorker myself, thinking about Woody Allen referring to, right. I think that was Annie Hall referring
the
to.
Best, the best cultural advantage of L.A. is making a left turn on a red light. Yeah. I guess that would be a right turn, actually.
But referring to L.A. as Munchkin Land because he came from New York, I just wonder as a native New Yorker and somebody who lived in the Bay Area
for all
those years, if your view of L.A. was like, oh, boy, just getting in there.
It was the only place I had ever said I would never live. I've lived in a lot of countries and a lot of cities, and I always looked forward to living in the next one. But this was, I'd spent some time there 10 years previously, and I just thought this is it's like a living museum of the worst the human race has to offer. And then I got the job offer there, and I went there, and it turned out I completely fell in love with the city. I think part of it is that the city itself has changed. People tell me that since TV and movies got a little smarter and there's cable and so there are smarter people and more interesting people and not just hustling people coming to create in that city. And it makes for a very, very juicy eavesdrop on any given corner.
Oh, I bet. Meredith Marin had to move to L.A. when things pretty much collapsed in her life in the Bay Area at age 60. She writes about it in her memoir, The New Old Me, My Late Life Reinvention. You talk about going to therapy and say that all I needed is someone to make sympathetic faces while I cry. How much of the ending of your marriage were you putting on yourself?
I'd say a fair amount, only 98%, something like that.
It's a low
percentage. 97 on a good day. Mm-hmm. I think when things fall apart, I have never wanted to be a victim. A victim role is not something I'm comfortable with. That's always been true. And so there aren't that many stories you can really fabricate when your whole life falls apart. There's the victim story and there's the, you know, life happens story. And I went with it's all your fault story. And I wouldn't say I thought it was all my fault, but I definitely was putting a lot of energy into figuring out my part in it. I think with some good results, but in retrospect, out to listeners out there, I would recommend raking yourself over the coals all day, every day as a real last resort strategy.
Not a first one, okay.
No.
Was there any contact with you and your ex in your early days in L.A.?
Not much, no, mm-hmm. No.
And what about friends from back in the Bay Area? I mean, you had a very good network of friends there.
I did.
You're disconnected with, but, you know, obviously in these days of cell phones, they could reach you instantly.
Oh, it was incredible. I mean, it's a six-hour drive, so it's not like moving to another country. The number of times people from the Bay Area would come down to when I did get enough money to try to rent a place, they would come and just drive around with me for days. And that every one of those days ended the same way, no matter who the friend was. They would, at the end of the day, put their arms around me and say, you know, you can come and just stay with me. Just come home with me. Because the places we were looking at for the budget that I had were terrifying. And they did that. They helped me organize my yard sale when I had to empty. I had a three-story Victorian in Oakland that was full of 60-year, well, you know, I had raised two kids there and lived there for 30 years. And they just, the friendship part of this story is so immense.
Did any of your friends in the Bay Area feel like they had to, like, pick sides? I know there's the, you know, in some divorces, it's like, oh, well, you know, she got these friends and I got those friends.
Oddly enough, no. And part of that is that many of the friends that my wife and I shared had been my friends because she had moved to the Bay Area fairly recently before we got together. But no, it was, I knew who my people were. They knew they were my people, and we stuck together and still do. Some of my closest friends, my best friends, still in San Francisco.
So you had been married before, as you point out, kids and all. How long? Man and all. Okay. Right. And how long since you'd been alone?
Never.
Really?
Never. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I basically had been married since the age of 15 to my first boyfriend, the one I met on the corner outside school. And then after that, I would have some period of time, sometimes between relationships, but I had been married to my kid's father for 12 years, then immediately got in a relationship with the first woman I ever was in love with. And we were together for 12 years, raised my kids together. And then not long after she and I broke up, I met my now ex-wife.
And how long were you married? Or how long were you together, I guess?
Well, we were together 16 years.
Mm-hmm. So it's a long time.
It's a long time.
A long time to watch everything drop away, which is exactly what happened at age 60 for Meredith Marin. Job, savings, marriage, all out the window, and a couple of other things that we have touched on briefly and haven't even talked about your father yet. We'll get to that. Her book is called The New Old Me, My Late Life Reinvention. She'll be speaking at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland tonight at 7. We'll have a few more minutes with her left here on the Jefferson Exchange. On the other side of a break, you're welcome to join by phone or by email. Back on the Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you so much for listening. We're talking about life and having to start all over at age 60 in the case of Meredith Marin, who was living in the Bay Area, married to a woman, had been with her for 16 years, had a great freelance career, had savings in the bank. All those disappeared practically overnight at age 60, and she picked up stakes in the Bay Area and moved to L.A. The story she tells in her memoir, The New Old Me, My Late Life Reinvention. Meredith will be at the Bloomsbury Books in Ashland tonight at 7. You can join the conversation here and now on the Jefferson Exchange, either about what you're hearing from her or some comparisons to your own life, perhaps. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. How did you start to reach out and make friends in L.A.? I mean, you talked about the people you worked with who were very different in age from you, but a few people would say, sure, let's do something Friday night.
Yeah, I met one woman, actually, not long after I started working at the fashion company. A friend of mine died, and we were sharing an office, and I read in my email that this friend had died, and I just kind of gasped, and she came over and put her arms around me without knowing anything about what was going on, and that friendship remains one of my closest 5 years later, and her daughter is my goddaughter. And so that happened. She was older than most of the people in the workforce. The other way I did it was to just realize that I was going to have to make a fool of myself. I was going to have to shatter the Facebook myth of life, because I was, of course, posting lots of gorgeous, color saturated pictures of, you know, Sunset Boulevard, and people were commenting on my Facebook page, "Wow, LA looks like it's really working for you." And of course, you know, not taking too many selfies because of the puffy eyes, etc. So I decided that I just had to tell the truth, and I went on Facebook and I said, "I'm lonely, and if any of you know anybody in LA you think I would like and who would like me, please put us in touch." And they did.
So there really was a lot of honesty that was required of you in this time, and that really paid dividends for you.
Yeah, it reminds me, there have been other times. This wasn't my first rodeo as far as breakups or heartache in various ways. And I do notice that the people now in my life, I'm 65 now, and the people I'm closest to often are people I met during the worst times. And there's something to learn from that, which is, when I'm fine and everything's groovy, I am probably less open, less real, less myself than I am when I have no resources. I have nothing to cover up with. So I was definitely that way the first year in LA, and I made incredible friends who remain friends today. So a few got lost by the wayside, you know, moving out of desperation, where I would hike with anybody who would walk next to me to a point of life where I'm being completely selective about who I hang out with. But most of the people are still very much in my life.
We had talked about your activism, which was it's a very wide stripe in your life. And it sounds like Occupy Oakland might have actually prolonged your marriage a bit.
It did. It's a strange thing in that way. Although I will say that, big world events, because of the fact that I grew up as an activist, I came of age, activism was the antidote to what I saw in my family's home and what I saw in the country in the late 50s, early 60s. It just seemed to solve everything. And the kinds of people I met through my activism seemed to be the kind of people I wanted to be with. So it just has been, yes, as you say, the thread, the through story of my life. And when the Occupy movement came along, my marriage was floundering. And there was one demonstration in particular where, even though my wife and I were really estranged at that point, we were living in the same house, but barely. And there was this one big demonstration being planned, and we knew it was probably going to be the biggest demonstration and the most diverse demonstration and the most earth-changing demonstration either of us would ever live to see. We just kind of looked at each other and said, let's go. And we went. And I look at the pictures from that day, and it was the weirdest thing to have a one-day reprieve from a war. It's like in real wars when they declare a peace. What is it when there's
a truce?
A one-day truce, and you think
a ceasefire.
Exactly. How can you be so mad at this other country and just stop being that mad for one day? We did that for a few months. We were very active in Occupy Oakland, in particular. We fed the homeless down there and camped out down there, and it was so exhilarating. I think, to this day, I feel, now with you-know-who in office and all of us feeling so much urgency about trying to save anything good that we have and keep him from having a fit at the expense of the planet. The relationships that I have now are also very much affected by the need to be going on demonstrations and bonding over making picket signs. And it feels very of a piece to me.
There's a real irony here that you point up in the book. You do not spare yourself much, I notice. It's just, there's a flogging to be had. You will happily deliver it to yourself. But but the irony of the fact that you work so hard for same-sex marriage in California and elsewhere and were a beneficiary of it and then ended up getting a divorce.
Yeah. It's, I think every minority group or oppressed group has this sense of variously called, is it good for the Jews? Or a lot of African-American people will say, you got to represent for the race. And in the case of gay marriage, getting married was so much a political act on our part and many of the people we knew. I never would have gotten married to a man. And I was very clear about that. I had been married once. I believed that legal marriage was something you did once, and even if it didn't last. And so I knew that I wouldn't have done that. I did it because it was the day before Proposition 8 passed in California that made gay marriage illegal again. It was just this yo-yo going on. And so we did it for emotional and political reasons. And so when it started to end and I realized that we were, at the time that we got married, we were one of 3,200 couples in the state of California. That's a pretty small number.
For
we were a
California,
special
yeah.
little group, yes. And they were making laws about us because we were the test case for how the state was going to deal with, and then the feds, obviously. And so to become, to be instead of 3,200, 3,199, and for us to be responsible for that just felt really awful, and also felt like it fed the stereotype, both within me, I'll say, as well as in the world, that gay relationships don't last.
We had talked about, just back to daily life now, living on other people's couches and other people's homes when they weren't there, that sort of thing. I mean, how long before you finally went apartment hunting for yourself for a more permanent kind of toehold in L.A.?
Yeah.
And East Bay real estate can be crazy enough. How did L.A. compare?
Well, as I said, it wasn't just the prices. It was what you got for the money. I mean, it was, at one point I was looking at a quote-unquote cottage in Hollywood that had no windows. And there was a homeless person who lived in the doorway.
Alley, no windows?
No windows. No kitchen also. And that was, I think, $2,200 a month. And in a very sketchy neighborhood. So it was very scary and upsetting. I had been a homeowner at that point for half of my life. And that had felt like quite a struggle to climb up out of paying someone else's mortgage to paying your own and to go back to this whole concept of first and last month. It was about close to 6 months of being in LA before I was able to get, quote unquote, first and last. And, you know, that was like $6,000. That's a lot of money to come up with when you're starting at zero. And I just remember writing that check to the landlord feeling so devastated. You know, it was like I'm 61 years old and I'm taking this huge step back. I haven't rented since I was 30. And I'm signing my name on a lease at an address that my wife doesn't even know. You know, that was to be signing up to live without her. That officially was really, really tough.
There must have been a few moments like that along the way in the early days where it was like, okay, this is really it. I'm on my own now.
There were so many milestones. And, you know, they say God only puts on your plate what you can handle. Well, I had overflowing dishes, you know. But there were definitely certain milestones. And I would say that I probably knew 3 years before I left Oakland that the marriage was not going to survive. I also knew going forward that however many years I had to live, even though there weren't that many left, I would always need to know that I had done everything I could do. So I don't regret those years of trying, but the moments of letting go were so slow and so agonizing, and I never knew where they were going to come from. And I'm sure half the people listening, if not more, have experienced grief. So you know that grief is very sneaky and sly, and it just pops up and grabs you the most unexpected thing or a smell or a song on the radio, whatever. And it would just feel like it was throwing me right back into the quicksand. But I will say, you know, that it did get better over time. You know, it's really true that time is your friend when you're recovering from grief.
But there was other letting go you had to do too, and other grieving. I mean, your father was still alive at that time, but slipping away. And so you had to let go there too, but there was a bit of an embrace. I mean, this is a very moving part of the book. Anybody who reads this is going to end up with a need for tissue boxes.
I'm going to read it tonight, I think, at the bookstore. Yes. Yes, it was a letting go, but it was also, I mean, I am not a new agey, cheesy Jonathan Livingston quoting whatever, but I will say this, that the letting go of my dad, which I had no choice about, he was dying, we got something together that is such a miracle. It really is. I mean, we knew we were having our last conversation. How often does that happen? And we both had lost enough at that point. In his case, his cognitive function. And in my case, everything we've been talking about. So that we came to each other just completely raw. And all that was left was love. So we, after, you know, 65 years of battle, we came to each other as comrades and, you know, father and daughter. And we had the most loving conversation of our lives, that last conversation.
And about 150 pages after you had said he wasn't a very good father, he said so too.
Right. He had never apologized for the bad things he'd done. I'd never really apologized for the bad things I had done. And I had no idea that he had an awareness that even though it had been the 50s when dads, you know, left the house for the 8:43 to wherever with their gray flannel suits, you know, they weren't expected to have such a role in parenting as, thank God, they are now. But I didn't know he knew that. I thought that he just thought, oh, well, you know, I did what the dads did. But it turns out that he actually had emotions for his children, and he actually knew that he wasn't participating in their childhoods, and that when he did, it was only as disciplinarian and very cruelly so in a lot of cases, including some physical violence. And so he was really grateful to apologize to me, and I was very grateful to apologize to him as well.
Places you sought out comfort. You mentioned God came into your life your first night in L.A. You do mention in the book going to Al-Anon. You were able to reach out in networks of people who were reaching for things beyond themselves.
Exactly, yes. And since the end of the book, in case anybody has read it and is commenting, as many people did, there's a lot of drinking in that book.
You can be in Al-Anon and drink, it turns out.
You can be in, and I proved it every Sunday. I've now stopped drinking as well, and I'm now going to AA as well. So I find that the philosophy of Judaism, actually, which I've never practiced but grew up with, is very much about doing the mitzvah. It's about taking yourself out of yourself by doing for someone else, or tikkun olam, which means heal the world. You know, it's very much a part of Judaism. In the case of Judaism, it's very much about we don't really deserve to be here, and the pogrom is coming, the Holocaust is coming, that, you know, they're out to get us. So let's deserve to be here, and let's make ourselves indispensable by changing the world. There's a tinge to the activism I saw growing up as a Jew that was uncomfortable for me. And in the 12-step programs that I'm involved with, I'm not doing much for anybody right now, but I do love the underlying philosophy that it's, you know, service is a good way to get your head out of your, let's just say, belly button.
Okay, very nicely done. Nice.
See, I do have there. Some tact, even though I'm a 60s person.
So I guess a final question, because we're almost out of time here, is a sense of humor goes a long way, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's one of my dad's gifts. Yes, he always said no matter how bad it is, laughter can only make it better. And yeah, I really love to laugh.
Okay, we have a little more time left. In writing the book, how much pain were you dredging up? I mean, reliving this versus getting a chance to put things in perspective and organize your thoughts about what you'd been through.
Right. Well, when I came to L.A., I knew I was going to write about this. And I took photos, as previously mentioned, for Facebook of L.A. and all its glory. And I knew that I would use that as my journal later because I couldn't stand to write. I was in too much pain. So I just took the pictures. And then when I was finally ready to start writing about 3 years later, I just used my Facebook feed as my journal.
Starting Over at Age 60 is the topic of Meredith Marin's book, The New Old Me, My Late Life Reinvention. She'll be appearing tonight at 7 at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland. And I want to thank you so much for joining us here in the Exchange today.
Great conversation. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.